Accession number 11, start again. Accession number 12268, Mr. Charles Biedman, reel 3.
Charles Biedman, reel 3. Biedman, reel 3.
We went back to Java and was sent to Bandung, which is Bandoeng, which is a delightful town in the mountains. A very pleasant climate because it was tropical, but being up in the mountains, it had cool mornings and evenings. And again, in the period before we really contacted the Japanese, a very pleasant existence, because the local Dutch had a very high lifestyle. We weren't in Bandung more than a few weeks before we went into action. Now, the Japanese knew that our own defense was light and that the range of our guns were 10,000 feet. So it was not a very difficult matter for them to fly at 12,000 feet and just bomb at their leisure. They went for this airdrome because obviously they were going to knock out airdromes, and they weren't very plentiful in Java. They did strafe us, but only after fairly extensive bombing. And on one occasion, I was at local headquarters when a raid was going to take place. We had dug slit trenches just to provide some sort of protection. I didn't like the look of these very much because they were something like about 3 foot deep. And I was caught in the raid, went into one of our houses, and there was one of our battery was suffering from malaria because due to our sojourn in Sumatra, I suppose a quarter of the battery were down with malaria. And this member of our headquarters staff was shaking violently with fever. I pushed him under a window to give him the protection of the wall. Meanwhile, bombs have been dropped, and to my horror, one of these slip trenches had collapsed. I knew there were men in there. I ran out, tried to scrabble with my hands, managed to dig a hole down to give some air, and could feel a man's face, and opened this up while this raid was taking place. Directly the raid was over, we dug them out, found two of them were dead, and this man, whose face I'd touched scandal, was alive because he'd had some air. But the shock of being entombed turned him into a different individual. And for the time I knew him, I found him quite morose and introverted. Very understandable, because it must be an awful shock to be suddenly entombed under the earth. Shortly after the bombing of the Bandung airdrome, the Dutch and ourselves had surrendered. We then left the aerodrome. And were ordered to put all our arms into different clumps. And one poor lad picked up a mine, which exploded, and lost his sight and all his limbs. So he was just a hulk. But he was a healthy hulk because he was young, something under 21, and I believe returned to England. I saw him because after after the surrender, I was working in one of the hospitals. And nobody had the courage to give him a sufficient dose of morphine to kill him. But I don't think this was anybody's fault particularly, it's just that things were happening so very fast. We were put into camps. And the colonel in charge of the camp sent for me and said the Japanese want some volunteers to take some Bedford trucks down to Bandung, you know, and we'd like you to go and let's have a report on what you see when you get back. I did this, and this is quite a hair-raising ride. To this day, the Japanese call their taxi drivers kamikaze, because these were suicide pilots, and the Japanese drive very fast and often quite recklessly. So we had a convoy of six trucks with British drivers hurtling through the mountains and taking bends at something like 50 miles an hour. And the Japanese treat us quite well on this occasion, except they beat up one of the drivers who was not very bright. And couldn't really keep up at this pace. We found that the Japanese, even in a short space of time, had bridged any rivers where the Dutch or British had blown up the existing bridges, and were good organisers. They fed us very well indeed, and indeed it's almost true of the Japanese that if you, they respect good work. They had no regard for us as prisoners, because this is foreign to Japanese mentality, or was foreign to Japanese mentality then, that you never surrendered, and indeed if a Japanese was taken prisoner of war, he was just struck off their records. As far as they were concerned, he was dead, gone. So they thought anybody who had surrendered wasn't really worth much consideration.
The surrender of Java, you know, were you yourself surprised to hear that the Allies had surrendered there? I wonder what your feeling was when the
surrender occurred. I wasn't surprised at all, because We really, really were quite inefficient. We hadn't got the planes. They had complete air superiority. We hadn't got the guns. And it was too small a force anyway. And there was no morale at all with the Dutch who were in command in Java.
What was your first impression also of the Japanese? You know, would these have been the frontline troops?
Yes, yes. Well, when I eventually met up with the Japanese, I found them good soldiery. And I never had any difficulty at all myself with the frontline troops. You have to appreciate that the people in charge of prison camps were often fourth and fifth line troops. And I'm certain that if you had conditions back here in England the same way, that you'd have a lot of stupidity with the prison guards, because they wouldn't be very efficient men at all. Having said that, the thing is tends to be a lot more complex than that. They entrained us from Bandung back to Batavia, and we were put into school, just a primary school. And the only food they were issued to us was Japanese style. I think bread was not existent, because yeast manufacturing had been bombed and there was virtually no yeast in Batavia then. They gave us rice, and Java was quite a wealthy country, so there was no shortage of food. Didn't instruct us at all how to cook rice. So several men died because they couldn't survive the watery mess our cooks made of it. It's not a difficult matter to cook rice properly. Do you want me to tell? Because the Oriental way is first of all to wash your rice thoroughly and to give it quite a sound pounding. This breaks up some of the starch structure. And having washed it 6 or 7 times, you then put it into a container and fill it with water up to about 1 inch above the surface, whatever the quantity. It's then put on a heater and boiled until pits arrive at the top of the rice. And at that stage, the heating stopped. You put a lid over the container, and as far as measures are concerned, I mean, sometimes these held many hundredweights. And then just let it simmer for 15 minutes or so in its own steam, and you have excellent rice. But we didn't know. And I can remember a chap called Foster, we used to call Freezer, dying because he just could not stomach this. And Freezer Foster was a very inoffensive man. He was a local journalist. But this, once again, is exigencies of war. After a couple of weeks in the school, they prepared a native prison for us in a place called Tan Jong Priok, which I think is spelled TanjongPriok, and it is near the harbour of Batavia. This was a native prison, and they sent 2,000 men there eventually. The latrine arrangements were very primitive. All they consisted of was channels dug in the earth that had running water. Water is very plentiful in Java because it tends to rain almost every day for a short while. Most men slept outside. These are tropical conditions, or as far as I was concerned myself, we slept under a roof, corrugated iron roof. I personally made a point to always have a shower before going to sleep, because, as I said, water was plentiful and there was always cold water showers available. It was always a good idea to wear something around your stomach, because the temperature drops in the early hours of the morning, and otherwise you tend to get upset stomachs quite easily. I personally found that I couldn't sleep under mosquito nets. They're just too hot and uncomfortable. And fortunately, as I said, I wasn't particularly bothered by malaria. Although I did have dengue and various other fevers, which are similar but not quite so severe. Moving to this camp, it was quite a ragtail and bobtail affair because the Japanese provided no transport except for the little bit of medical equipment that we had. And one of the Royal Army Service Corps officers asked me if I would smuggle a radio set in. I don't think I was very happy about this.
Why you? What facilities had you in order
because
to do that?
Because I was going on a truck to take medical supplies, and the reason for that was that the regimental doctor, Dr. Barclay, was a friend of mine, and when we were in this native school, I asked him if I could assist, because we had men coming out of the jungle with all sorts of jungle sores and ulcers, and there was lots of dysentery and malaria, and I was keen on medicine. If I could assist, I was happy to do so. So he readily agreed, and then he said, well, stay by me, you know, and keep some of your studies going. And then we had two guards colonel in charge of the camp, and they sent for me and asked me if I was prepared to take over the administration of sickness for the camp. And in addition to this, I had a skin clinic of my own because this had been my training. So I was quite happy to be occupied and do the job. So when we were moved from the school to this native prison, I went on the truck with supplies. And I dealt with this radio by putting it into a dustbin, which was 3/4 full of cotton wool. And I felt it probably would be safe if I didn't tie the thing down. We landed outside the walls of the native prison and had to wait for the main contingent to arrive. And they were walking, so this took some hours. And to my great horror, while I was waiting, various bored Japanese sentries would come along and would poke and prod into these supplies. And after they'd done this 2 or 3 times, I'm sure they did because they were just bored. And on one occasion, the Japanese put his bayonet into this particular dustbin where the radio was, counted this cotton wool, and moved off. So we got our radio in to the camp. I can remember that my heart sank when I saw this prison, because it had forbidding walls. They must have been something like 15 foot high, and it was in fact a native prison. But there it was. I felt better once the troops and my friends arrived, and in we went. We took over the hospital as such. The hospital must be an absolute misnomer. There was still a gibbet because they had condemned cells which were used for dysentery patients because they were separate and isolated. And these were just very narrow cubicles about 4 foot wide, I would think, and perhaps 6 foot deep. And I remember one poor lad who kept a record of the times he had to go and told me they'd been 99 times in one day. Dysentery is a dire thing. And if you get amoebic dysentery, it can be fatal most times. And of course, dysentery in a sense is what war is all about.
Well, what is it about amoebic dysentery which is so dire?
Because it's a serious bacterial infection in the intestines, which tends to ulcerate. And then once this breaks, I mean, it just hemorrhages and people die. Plus the fact, I mean, the dehydration that you get with dysentery anyway. I myself only ever had a sort of mildish dose, but even to this day, you know, I can get some recurrence. Because there's obviously a sort of weak spot or so somewhere in my intestines. We had this hospital, the main ward as such was open onto a patio because the tropical conditions you didn't need walls. All the beds were bug and louse infected, so we burnt them. And in a camp of 2,000 men, you get experts of all types. So I found myself an agricultural expert who laid down gardens, and the men who were going out to work would bring us back plants and things like canna lilies, which grew absolutely prolifically out there, and peppers. The Japanese are very keen on gardens, so even they got enthusiastic, and this made the place look better. We made our own beds. There's quite an amount of wood available, and instead of mattresses, we just made a rope netting and creosoted and really put something up. Had some lovely brick ovens built because we had very many bricklayers who were highly specialised. And began to get the thing sort of under control. I used to liaise with a Japanese corporal, and it always astounded me how much responsibility the Japanese gave their NCOs, because in this country it wouldn't have been anybody under the rank of major or colonel in charge of a couple of thousand prisoners. I found him all right, and indeed, as I said, all the first line Japanese troops I ever met up with, all right. We had not too much trouble. People obviously would step out of line, or I mean, just didn't understand what the Japanese required.
Did you have problems with language? I was wondering. Because Japanese is so different, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. A lot of the soldiers picked up a fair amount of Malan, which is quite a simple language. And the Japanese taught us one or two sort of words which they thought were important, like danger, abnai, you know, that sort of thing. And it's amazing how people can make themselves understood, particularly when it's backed with a bit of force. The only thing that seemed to trouble the Japanese was the fact that we had radio contact. They knew this because every time there was good news come through, people would almost cock a snoop at the guard. The main guard room was inside the camp. And they used to search the place upside down. Well, the main radio was underneath a garden, a little flower bed, And they'd built a little brick cache there, put this radio in it, and then there was a tin roof to it that was full of earth and had some flowers on top of it. And many men, as I've said, used to sleep outside because of the conditions, and the particular officers that responsible for this radio would simply put in a lead and have an earphone within something like 40 yards of the Japanese guard room. Now, a problem was the charging of batteries, because in those days, I suppose even today, I mean, they're battery fed. This was overcome because we used to bake bread. This time we'd got yeast, and I'll tell you what happened there. And the bakers who were on all night used to play darts. And this intrigued the Japanese, and the Japanese sentries would often come in and play darts with them. And while this electricity light was on, it was charging the batteries. Now, what happened about the bread was that there was masses of flour in Java, in Batavia, no yeast. And among the prisoners was a former curator of the Raffles Museum in Singapore. And he instructed the working parties to bring back any rotten form of vegetation, fruit, bananas, oranges, anything else like this. And he had got a very simple microscope, and eventually he isolated a yeast culture. And from that, yeast growth developed very, very quickly. Just grew and eventually supplied the whole of Batavia with yeast. So, no particular problems. I really am always astounded how resourceful people are and how they get through.
It's interesting, you're talking about the news, that you were getting the news.
Yes.
And that the Japanese knew you were getting the news. Yes. Because, you know, from your action.
Elation. Yeah.
But was there any good news while you were on Java?
Oh, yes.
Because this is quite early on in the war, isn't it?
Oh, yes. But you're getting good news coming out of the Middle East with Montgomery. So, on occasions it was there. And it's an interesting fact that we always did have news all the way through, even in Japan, you know.
Well, was that wise to let the Japanese know that you were getting news? You know, I was wondering, this raised the issue.
You can't stop it with 2,000 men. Because the news went just like wildfire. I mean, if Montgomery had pushed Rommel back. Right, some would say, Montgomery's pushed on back, woof, it was right the way through. Most reasonable people would keep it to themselves. But as I say, with a lot of the soldiery, they would just march past the guard room and they wouldn't do that because they're afraid of offending the Japanese. But they would sort of let them know, you're getting pushed back, it's only time before it's there, and this is our particular victory, etc. This was too much of a coincidence. So the Japanese knew that we were getting the news. Another thing we did, which I think the German prisoners of war did, was to put in radios into the lower half of a water bottle, because we took us there. And the way that they got the materials for this was that a lot of them worked on a big car complex, car parts. And if you get a car part complex, you get everything. We had sort of radio valves and the rest of it. And you can't help stop men smuggling things in. They one way or another come in, might put a coil of wire around an arm under a sleeve and that type of thing, this would always happen. So we had this, And conditions weren't bad in Java because provided you had something at all, natives would always swap. They'd always have things there. One trouble we had, great trouble, once we got into this native camp, is we had no medical supplies. And we'd been dealing with emergency medical supplies. And the Japanese hadn't any, because their frontline troops were very self-sufficient. So they gave them absolute minimum.